This is the Israel Connection on 88 FM and streaming over the internet at j-air.com.au. My name is David Schulberg, bringing you another episode of this weekly radio program that provides analysis and insight with important interviews and discussion about Israel. Jonathan Speier is a British Israeli analyst, writer and journalist of Middle Eastern affairs. He's director of research at the Middle East Forum, editor of Middle East Quarterly magazine, a fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security, a freelance security analyst and correspondent for Jane's Information Group, and a columnist for the Jerusalem Post. Tensions on Israel's northern border have escalated to the point where Israel has declared that it is ready for all-out war against Hezbollah if necessary. What might trigger such an eventuality, and what could be the consequences of such an escalation? Is the threat real, or are we seeing the use of strong rhetoric as a deterrent against an all-out war? I'd like to welcome Jonathan Speier to the Israel Connection on J-Air Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia. Nice to have you on the show, Jonathan.
Hi, David. Nice to be here.
Tensions on Israel's northern border have escalated to the point where Israel has declared that it is ready to go all out in a war against Hezbollah if necessary. What might trigger such an eventuality, and what could be the consequences of such an escalation of the tensions?
Yes, well, first of all, we should understand some background in order to understand why tensions have reached the point that they have. Hezbollah from Lebanon began attacks on Israel on October 8th, just one day following the October 7th massacres. And these attacks have continued on a daily basis since October 8th. And the result is that Israel is now in a tricky situation, because while tactically Israel still very much has the upper hand in the clashes, around 349 Hezbollah fighters are acknowledged to have died, to have been killed by Israel in the course of the fighting. And that compares to only 15 Israeli troops and 10 civilians. So tactically Israel has the upper hand, but on the strategic level, Hezbollah has succeeded in emptying out the north of Israel. Israel now, or the northern border area, I mean, to a depth of about 5 kilometers. That's an untenable situation long-term from Israel's point of view. So Israel needs to find some way to unblock the situation. And that is the reason why Israeli policymakers are making it clear that an operation of one kind or another to unblock that situation and make it possible for the residents of border communities, around 60,000 people, to return to their homes may be imminent. It's not clear if it actually is imminent, because it's become apparent that the United States administration is very much opposed to any Israeli initiative in that regard. It remains to be seen if Israel will feel it has the bandwidth to launch an operation of that kind. A major clash could begin also inadvertently. Should it be the case, for example, that one of Hezbollah's launch of drones or missiles were to take a very large toll of civilian life or military life, that might lead to an Israeli response that could then lead to an escalation. So the situation is very tense indeed. And the big question, I think, really is the question of Israeli will. Is Israel willing to push forward to unblock the situation, or will that in fact not take place? That's going to be decided, I think, in the weeks ahead. I say that's the question because it's very clear that Hezbollah itself and Iran behind it are not looking to escalate. What they want to do is simply to maintain the status quo and maintain fire on Israel for as long as the war in Gaza continues. So that's the question which is facing. And the last point to make is that from an Israeli point of view, if a ceasefire came in Gaza and then the status quo ante bellum, so to speak, was to be re-established in the Lebanese border, that would not be an acceptable outcome, because from the point of view of Israeli civilians, a situation in which Hezbollah is deployed all the way to the border, which was the situation prior to October 8th, is just not acceptable anymore, given the dangers that would mean of a possible rerun on a much larger scale of the October 7th massacres, but taking place on the Israel-Lebanese border area.
But we're seeing a lot of the use of strong rhetoric, which could be interpreted as a deterrence against the advent of a full-scale war. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've seen Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, using very bellicose language to threaten Cyprus if any kind of assistance is given to Israel. We've seen latest revelations that Beirut Airport is being used as a storage facility for Hezbollah weaponry. Now, these are very ominous signs, as I think you would agree.
Well, absolutely, yes. With regard to those issues, first of all, looking at Rafik Hariri International Airport in Beirut, it's an airport that I've been through a number of times in the course of my work, as have many other journalists and researchers working this beat. It's an open secret, so to speak, that the airport is under the de facto control of Hezbollah. Indeed, arguably, the commanding heights of Lebanon itself, economically, militarily, and politically, are under the command of Hezbollah and therefore Iran today. The security force that checks your passport as you come into Rafik Hariri International Airport, the Sûreté Générale, is the force that works in close cooperation with Hezbollah and its allies. Hezbollah, as we know, has made use of, or as it seems clear, has made use of the ports and of airports in Lebanon in the past. It's worth noting that in 2008, if you remember, there was quite serious internal clashes in Lebanon between Hezbollah at that time and Amal on the one side, and Saad Hariri and the pro-Western or pro-Saudi forces on the other. Worth remembering, what triggered that was an attempt by the then government of Saad Hariri to replace the head of security at Rafik Hariri International Airport, a man called Wafik Shuker. So the sensitivity of the airport and Hezbollah's de facto domination of it is not news. Given that domination, it's hardly surprising if they have de facto control of an area that that area would be used for the ongoing transfer of weaponry from Iran to Lebanese Hezbollah. And indeed, now proof appears to be emerging or emerging into the public space that that is in fact what's happening. So it shouldn't surprise anybody. I assume that the article in the London Daily Telegraph was leaked, perhaps from pro-Israel side, in order to make it clear on the public level that Israel knows where Hezbollah lives, so to speak. It knows where Hezbollah's main points of focus and vulnerability are. And in the event of a war, we should take it for granted that Israel will hit what it requires, is what it finds it necessary to hit. Nasrallah's statements regarding Cyprus are kind of the same thing coming from the other direction, as I see it. In other words, it's Hezbollah trying to say, well, don't forget, we have all kinds of capabilities. Capabilities are not only on the ground, they're also with regard to the naval area. And they're saying to Israel, well, you're vulnerable in all kinds of ways in the Mediterranean. Don't forget, you've got those offshore gas rigs. You've also got that good relationship with the current government in Cyprus, with lots of with significant cooperation taking place. And therefore, we can hit at those areas too. So, yeah, there's a kind of war of words and war of information underway. And these are two examples, I think, coming each from each of the different sides, which are elements of that.
The Beirut Airport, mentioning that, is to remind the Lebanese of the port explosion in 2020, which they wouldn't want a recurrence of something similar, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that informed opinion regarding the port explosion in 2020, obviously one of the largest man-made explosions actually in recent history. I mean, an enormous explosion taking place because of ammonium being stored apparently unsafely in the Beirut port area. Ammonium is a known preferred material used by Hezbollah in its activities, also in its terror activities in Europe and in Britain. There are examples on record of its storage of ammonium. The circumstantial evidence, at least, will point to the fact that that explosion took place as a result of Hezbollah's storage of weaponry and Hezbollah's apparent lack of sufficient competence to secure weaponry safely. Hezbollah's sabotage of any investigation into the explosion subsequent to August 2020, I think, just confirms that impression. So yes, Hezbollah has its vulnerabilities, and certainly Israel will be keen to point those out. And in the event of war, of course, to take advantage of them. And when we think about Lebanon, we should remember that there isn't really a Lebanese force or Lebanese government outside of Hezbollah control. Any idea that, no, you have the Lebanese state over here and then Hezbollah over there, which of course was the notion maintained during the last round of hostilities in the summer of 2006. is no longer to be maintained today. Hezbollah is in the government, Hezbollah is in the parliament, Hezbollah is deeply infiltrated into the armed forces. And of course, Hezbollah has its own parallel state within Lebanon, which is more powerful than the official state itself. So there's no question of sort of locating which bits of Lebanon Hezbollah is in. That's not what's going on here. Hezbollah is in every part of Lebanon, and Israel's pointing out that it knows where the most sensitive spots are located.
Yes. Now, I shared with you an ABC report that came out over the weekend in which Bilal Saab, who's the head of the US Middle East Practice of Trends Research and Advisory, spoke addressing the question as to whether we're about to see the war in Gaza break out on a new front. I want to play a short excerpt thereof and invite your reaction, Jonathan.
If I were to summarize what could really trigger a conflict, it really isn't strategic considerations on either side. It's more of the political logic of the Israeli government, and it's specifically this prime minister who is seeking to ensure his political survival over anything else. And if that leads to another war in the northern frontier, then so be it. This is where the political logic supersedes strategic and security and military considerations. I don't think it's that controversial or counterintuitive or crazy to postulate that the prime minister's number one priority is political survival. As a matter of fact, the United States government went public with precisely that argument, that the prime minister's top priority is political survival. I think he understands better than anybody that the moment the fighting stops in Gaza is when the Israeli public, which is very angry with the prime minister, is going to punish him politically and probably lead to the collapse of the government. So as long as shots are getting fired, either in Gaza or on the northern frontier, no one is going to hold him accountable for the time being.
What do you make of this analysis of the tit for tat going on currently between Israel and Hezbollah, with pointing the finger at Netanyahu for being one of the main protagonists wanting the war to continue?
Well, first of all, it should never be ruled out in the case of any politician that that politician may partly be informed or motivated by his own political needs. I mean, I think we'd be naive in the extreme if we were to look at any politician. That includes Netanyahu, by the way, it includes President Joe Biden as well, and includes any other politician. You know, when we're looking at what politicians do, we should never rule out the aspect of their own political interest. Anybody who's worked in the political field knows that that's what all politicians spend quite a bit of the day thinking about, and we need to not kid ourselves that it's otherwise. Having said that, I think if we look at the objective, if I can put it that way, I mean, the conditions that maintain in Lebanon regarding the Israel-Lebanese border, which I was talking about a little bit earlier, it's a fact that any leader, Netanyahu or anybody else, faced with that situation would have to be thinking about the possibility or ways to dislodge the current bloc. In other words, take any conceivable Israeli prime minister facing any conceivable sort of political set of circumstances, and that prime minister, if he or she was faced with a situation in which a Islamist organization committed to Israel's destruction has emptied out the border to a depth of 5 kilometers, has turned 60,000 Israelis into refugees in their own country, that politician would have to be thinking about counteraction to unblock that situation. That's just built in or baked in to the situation. So I'm not sure how helpful it really is to be saying, well, you know, this is only happening because of Netanyahu's political interests. I don't think that's, frankly, an entirely serious point. I think also we should bear in mind that when it comes to Netanyahu, and indeed I would say also Hassan Nasrallah on the other side, these are politicians who are not characterized by sudden, impulsive uses of force. Nasrallah did that, of course, in 2006 and set and triggered the 2006 war, and is on the record as having said he regrets that. I don't think that Nasrallah is looking for an all-out war at the present time. Of course, he's committed to Israel's destruction. I just mean tactically, I don't think he wants it. Netanyahu is somebody also who has never been characterized by the reckless use of force. I think that Netanyahu, maybe more than some other Israeli politicians we can think of, or state or officials we can think of, is likely to be thinking very carefully, given his record, before authorizing any major use of force in Lebanon. We know, and it's on the record, that Netanyahu indeed intervened to prevent a major Israeli incursion against Hezbollah in the early part of the war, which was favored by Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. So I think it's not entirely an accurate or useful characterization of this, that, yeah, Netanyahu wants war in Lebanon to save his political neck, which is kind of what Bilal Saab was kind of saying. Having said that, I'm not in any way dismissing the issue of internal political considerations, and I think it's maybe a more appropriate judgment if we look at what's happening in Gaza. There, I think you can make a legitimate, at least, contention that Netanyahu, the current strategy being employed in Gaza, which many of us here do see as kind of directionless, and it's not clear where it's heading. You could make an argument is perhaps to do with the fact that Netanyahu knows that the day after the firing stops, there's going to be demands for a state commission of inquiry into why October 7th happened and how it happened, calls for his resignation and calls for election. So I'm not in any way ruling out the possibility of political considerations interfering with statesmanship. But when it comes to the issue of Lebanon, given the objective situation on the ground there, and especially given Netanyahu's traditional caution, known caution with regard to the use of the armed forces, in my judgment, at least, that's not an appropriate or correct assessment of what's currently taking place and the dynamics behind it.
Yeah, thanks for that assessment, Jonathan. I want to go and look at UN Resolution 1701, which was passed after the 2006 Lebanon War. For my listeners, just I would like to say that this resolution was approved unanimously, calling for the full cessation of hostilities then, the deployment of Lebanese forces to southern Lebanon, parallel withdrawal of Israeli forces beyond the blue line, strengthening the UN force, UNIFIL, to facilitate the entry of Lebanese forces in the region, and the establishment of a demilitarized zone between the blue line and the Litani River. It also called for UN Secretary General to develop proposals to implement the relevant provisions of the TAFE Accords, as well as Security Council resolutions 1559 and 1680 that had passed previously, and impose an arms embargo on Lebanon. The resolution was formally agreed to by both parties and within 48 hours of its adoption. Is this the key to prevent full-scale war breaking out between Israel and Hezbollah, or is it yet another example of the deplorable failure of the United Nations?
Well, I think it's the latter, and I think that the evidence is out, right? I mean, it's 17 years now, getting on for 18 years since the summer war of 2006, and we know that Resolution 1701, almost from the day it was passed, was a dead letter, and that Hezbollah began the process of rebuilding its presence south of the Litani and all the way to the border with Israel, literally on the day following the war. And there's no big mystery as to how they did it. We know that we know well where they're located and how they're doing it. Before 2006, there were the famous nature reserves that we knew of out there in the countryside, these Hezbollah positions. And we know that now Hezbollah has rebuilt itself much more tightly woven into populated areas south of the Litani River. But the point is that it was clear that was going to happen from the outset. And the reason is very simple. It's that there is no force either able or willing to challenge Hezbollah south and its will south of the Litani. You mentioned two forces. One is the Lebanese Armed Forces, let's say the official Lebanese army. And the other is the UNIFIL, the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon. The Lebanese Armed Forces is heavily infiltrated by Hezbollah itself. Many of its officers and many of its soldiers are Shia Lebanese from the south of the country or from elsewhere, whose own families are affiliated with Hezbollah or with Amal, the allied Shia Islamist movement. So Lebanese Armed Forces is simply not a force fit for purpose. It cannot, even if it wished to, take on Hezbollah, because many of the people within it are, if not loyal to Hezbollah and providing information to Hezbollah, which many of them are, at least certainly neutral with regard to it, which means that if the army tried, which it's in any case not going to do, but if it were to try to take on Hezbollah, the result is that the army would split and cease to be a working military force. And with regard to UNIFIL, UNIFIL in a sense sort of confirms the whole illusion of the United Nations. I mean, the United Nations presents itself as this kind of extra national body. It's not. UNIFIL consists of forces from member states. And within all those member states, there is nothing like approaching the political will to take on Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, with the cost that that would imply of young men from the countries in question, soldiers coming home in body bags. There just isn't anything like the political will in that area, which means that in practice, what's happened, 1701 notwithstanding, since the ceasefire that ended the 2006 war is a kind of live and let live attitude of the forces south of the Litani River. Lebanese armed forces and UNIFIL just kind of agree not to bother Hezbollah. They carry out their patrolling, they carry out their checkpoints. Hezbollah carries out its rearming, Hezbollah carries out its exercise, Hezbollah carries out its deployments close to the border with Israel, and these forces just don't bother it. And they aren't going to bother it any time in the future. And as a result of that, 1701 exists only on paper. 1701 can say whatever it wants, and those who support it can say whatever they want. Hezbollah has been rebuilding south of the Litani since the very day of the ceasefire, the end of the 2006 war, and it is now vastly stronger, exponentially stronger than it was on the eve of the 2006 war, as a result of that busy rebuilding that's taken place now for the last over a decade and a half.
So we should put 1701 in the rubbish bin?
1701 is just not fit for purpose. If the purpose is to ensure that the area south of the Litani is empty of Hezbollah armaments, arms and fighters, then it's just not fit for purpose. And it's worth mentioning that if another such resolution were to be passed, but the resolution is not accompanied by an actual changing of the balance of forces on the ground south of the Litani, then it will be a similar dead letter, just like 1701 followed 1559, and 1559 was a dead letter, and 1701 is too. Its successors also will be, unless something actually changes on the ground in South Lebanon.
Right. The U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General Charles Brown has stated that the U.S. is likely to be unable to assist Israel in war with Hezbollah. He's asked Israel to think of how a war would affect the region, as well as the impact it would have on U.S. forces. What do you make of this ambivalence coming from the US?
Unfortunately, the Biden administration just does not have a clear strategic picture or conception of the need to hold and roll back Iranian influence across the region. The Iranians are launching a bid for dominance in the Middle East. They have busily, over the last decades, seeded proxy militias in a whole variety of strategic points across the region. And since October 7th, they have activated a partial mobilization of those militias. And as a result of that, the Houthis, the Ansar Allah militia in Yemen, have virtually closed down shipping along a key maritime trade route, the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea, leading up to the Suez Canal. Hezbollah, we've been talking about, have been attacking Israel on a daily basis and have closed down the Israel-Lebanon border area on the Israeli side. And the Iraqi Shia militias are shooting at Israel on a daily basis. And up until February, at least, and sporadically since then, they were also carried out more than 100 attacks on U.S. forces deployed in Iraq and Syria. This is the picture as it pertains. Unfortunately, what we see is there isn't a similar will on the American side to roll that back. And I would say that it's exemplified in what we're talking about here, which is there isn't a clear understanding of the need for a U.S. regional ally, Israel, to take decisive action against an Iranian ally, Hezbollah, which has been attacking it since October the 8th. Instead, I think what there is a kind of desire to manage the situation. The Americans want to bring the Gaza war to an end. They think that once the Gaza war ends, this mobilization by Iran will end too. And that will end the possibility of a Middle East conflagration taking place at the time when we're approaching the United States presidential elections. That's what I think the United States position is. And I think Brown, the Air Force General Brown's statements over the last 24 hours reflect that. And I'm sure that Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who of course is now in Washington, who met with Envoy on Lebanon Amos Hochstein yesterday and will meet with Secretary of Defense and the National Security Advisor in the days ahead, we'll be hearing similar messages. The Americans absolutely want to maintain industrial quiet, so to speak, in the build-up to the presidential election, and they have no clear strategic conception of what needs to be done. And unfortunately, that's, I think, reflected in these statements. I'm not in any way trying to belittle the very significant assistance that the United States has afforded Israel since October 7th, including, of course, the visit by President Joe Biden, but I don't think we can allow that to obscure the deeper reality, which is that the current administration just doesn't have clarity of thought when it comes to the Iranian challenge in the region and its policy choices. Its cautious and partial policy choices reflect that, and no area more so than in the current very, very tense matter of Israel and Hezbollah on the Israel-Lebanese border.
Yeah, he asserted, General Brown asserted, that the safety of US forces was the priority, was paramount, and reiterated that no attacks had been carried out on US bases in the region since February. So stayed away from the US bases. So the US is not really in the mood, I suppose, to stir things up.
Yes, I mean, it's worth remembering that the Iraqi Shia militias killed three American service personnel on January 28th, and that was the last major attack to have taken place. At the same time, the militias are continuing to attack US allies also in Syria and Iraq, and of course also with regard to Israel. My own sense, again, is that there needs to be strategic clarity here. There is a challenge underway to the security architecture of the region. It's led by Iran. It's including a whole number of its proxies. And the choice can either be made to resist that or not to resist it. The choice to not resist it, if a ceasefire comes in Gaza when it comes and the Iranians just stop, it will be remembered that the Houthis were able to terrorize shipping along the Gulf of Aden and Red Sea, to require the United States, Armed Forces, United States Navy to spend enormous amounts of resources in order to try to resist that in an entirely defensive way, and they failed to stop it. The Iranians will understand from that the following lesson. Okay, so we can basically do whatever we want for as long as we want, and when we choose to stop, there'll be no comeback. That is a very, very dangerous lesson to allow an aggressor to learn. Iran is the aggressor in this region, so it needs to be understood that lesson. They should not be allowed to take that lesson away from the events of the last 9 months. And that should mean a proactive forward strategy against Iran of hitting their assets in order to deter them. But that, I'm afraid, is not currently in the minds of the United States administration. And while I'm sure that the public statements by Gallant and maybe Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin or whoever else will be positive, that's in a sense an attempt, I think, to cover over a fact that there is a very, very deep difference in thinking here between those like Yoav Gallant, who would like to move forward and deliver some very serious blows to Iran's assets in the region, and those in the US administration today who absolutely and emphatically do not want to do that.
Yes. Yes, indeed. You've been listening to an abbreviated version of an interview with Jonathan Speier, a British-Israeli analyst, writer, and journalist of Middle Eastern affairs, talking about the looming danger of a breakout of all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah on Israel's northern border. The full interview in which Jonathan Speier discusses the role of Hamas in Lebanon will be made available as a separate podcast. My next guest is Dr. Sean Goltz, who has taken a manuscript that was written by Tzvi Alpaleg, who was an academic, author, and the senior researcher at the Dayan Institute at Tel Aviv University. In the mid-1950s, Alpaleg was the military governor of the Triangle, a concentration of Israeli Arab towns and villages adjacent to the Green Line, located in the eastern Sharon Plain among the Sumerian foothills. And from 1956 to 57, he was the military governor of Gaza. Alpaleg became Israel's first military governor of the West Bank in 1967. He would repeat the role during the Israeli occupation of the Fayyid region, the district around the city of Ismailia in Egypt, in 1973. And again he served as military governor in occupied South Lebanon in 1982. He was Israel's ambassador to Turkey from 1995 to 1997. So I'd like to welcome Sean Goltz to the Israel Connection. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm really privileged to be in the show and talk about this fascinating book.
Yes, that's what we're talking about today, a book titled From Victory to Disaster, The 6 Days War and the Massacre at the Nova Festival. When I first found out about this book, totally by accident, when I was browsing on internet and making some remarks on a post, I discovered that the book was written by Tzvi Alpaleg, who died in 2015. So can you please explain the evolution of this book for us, please, Sean?
Tzvi is a relative of mine. He's the uncle of my wife. And I met Tzvi around 2007 And that was a few years before I left Israel to do my PhD in Toronto, Canada. And beyond the family relationships and the fact that Zvi was a fascinating person, very generous and kind and very smart, one of the things we talked about is his manuscript. So at that time, after his long life service in the Israeli army, being an ambassador, basically saying the same thing all over again, and that's the gist of the book, he was looking for an editor to edit the book and publish it finally. And we had some discussions around it. It didn't came to work. And then I left Israel. I know he tried a few other editors. And eventually, Zvi passed away in 2015, and the manuscript was not published, and it was in Hebrew. Then fast forward to 2023, when I always knew this book needs to be published, that it's a very important book, and it needs to be published. Then in 2023, October 7, when the events happened in Israel, I realized I need to publish this book because, in a way, for me, the events of October 7 was some kind of a prophecy that is written in the book, even though the book was finalized somewhere in 2015, so about 8 years earlier. Turns out that the widow of Zvi, Michal Snonit, very known Israeli poet and author, she gave it to the Dayan Center in Tel Aviv, and they just didn't do anything with it. It was just lying, collecting dust on their shelves in the archive. I managed to talk to Michal. We asked the Dayan Center to bring back the manuscript. I've edited it and translated it for about 3 months, which was, it was, on one hand, it was a fascinating process because it was just like talking to Zvi while he's already dead. I also wanted to make it in English because I felt that it will gain more audience this way. It will be more accessible to more people, but also because Zvi was saying those same things again and again during his tenure, during his career, and no one in Israel really listened to him, I thought it better to publish it in English. I'm not saying it will not be published in Hebrew as well. I've edited it very heavily. I've translated it into English. That's the kind of a frame story around the book.
Yeah, so what you wrote in addition to what Zvi Elpelig had written was about October the 7th and also kind of a foreword about explaining the book, yes? At the start
Correct.
Of the book.
Yes, so everything in the book, apart from the biographies of the people that are involved in the last chapter around October 7th, were all written by Zvi, apart from a short introduction that I've added at the beginning. I didn't want to burden the reader with too much information that is not what Zvi has written. I wanted to give Zvi's perspective and Zvi's argument the central piece in this book. I thought it would be helpful to add the biographies of the people involved for readers that are interested in more background around the story, because, you know, as one reader wrote to me, this is like an autopsy from the inside that spans decades. If someone wants more background, they can read the biographies of those people. I also added the piece around October 7. It is important to mention that Zvi's original name for the book was From Victory to Disaster. So it's the same name. I'm the one that added From the 6 Days War, which was the original intention, to the massacre at the Nova Festival, because for me, that was the highlight of this disaster, how Moshe Dayan and others in the Israeli government throughout the years have managed to take such a glorious victory in the 6 Days War and turn it into this amazing farce that is mentioned in the book and ending up with this terrible massacre. It's important to maybe summarize Zvi's argument throughout the book very shortly to say that Israel, and especially led by Moshe Dayan after the 6 Days War, were both arrogant and ignorant. So they were arrogant in the sense that they thought they would bring democracy to the Palestinians in the occupied territory. And they were ignorant because they didn't understand the nature and the culture of Arabic people. And, you know, it's interesting. One of the pieces I didn't manage to squeeze into the book is a citation of the late wife of Moshe Dayan. And she was saying that Moshe Dayan didn't really know how to speak good Arabic. She told him, your Arabic is good enough to talk to the peasants, but now you need to talk to the nobility. You need to talk to those Palestinians. And he just didn't have the Arabic to speak about it. But this is very symbolic in the sense that he did not understand their culture. When Moshe Dayan pushed towards election, democratic elections in the occupied territory, he didn't understand that it will be leveraged by the PLO to take control over the occupied territories. And for me, you know, even though a lot of water has fled through the Jordan River since 1967 and until 2023, it's all about the beginning, how you manage your control over those people. And Israel had its own experience in the triangle with the Arab Israelis, where Israel managed everything and they were very loyal citizens eventually. There was no shooting, there was no violence. Whereas in the occupied territory, in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank after the 6 days war, when Israel was all about, we will be kind and generous with you and we'll bring you democracy and we'll enlighten you and you will be generous towards us and kind toward us. This just blew in the face of everyone eventually. And that's what Zvi was basically saying all across those maybe 40 years, but no one listened.
Clarify, please, for the listeners, when you refer to the triangle and the area that Zvi had responsibilities for, what was that area exactly and what role did he have?
Before 1967, for 19 years, Israel was basically occupying the Israeli Arabs in the area of Tibet and I think it's Jeljulia. And so it's somewhere in the north of Israel, as well as the Bedouins and the other Arab Israelis that were in the territory of Israel. Now, Zvi was one of the governors of the Triangle area, which is considered Arab Israelis. Eventually, they became citizens. And my understanding, and this is not written in the book, but Zvi is basically saying, if we would have treated the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank the same way that we treated the Arab Israelis, meaning we control everything and eventually you become Israeli citizens, all this may not have happened. But the approach was very different. Moshe Dayan said, And this is cited in the book, a Palestinian person should be born, married, raise their kids, do all those things without seeing one time one Israeli soldier or one Israeli official. And Zvi is saying, this is not the Palestinian culture. This is not the Palestinian, the way the Palestinians and the Muslims in general see occupiers. If they're not dependent on the occupier, they will try to kill the occupier. And that's what eventually happened. It's funny to see in 67 or a bit later when Moshe Dayan is saying, we don't need the soldiers to be on the ground. It's enough for us to have the airplanes on the hill and so on and so forth. And that blew into our face in October 7 when all the electronic surveillance devices and everything just became ridiculous in the face of thousands of bloodthirsty Hamas terrorists that just stormed all those obstacles and killed and raped and murdered and you name it. One of the things that is interesting in this book is to see this chronology that started in 67 and just went on and escalated. And people may say, well, after 10, 20 years of Israeli occupation after the 6 days war, Israel was not so kind with the Palestinians. But the point is that Israel then didn't have a choice because after they initiated democratic elections, which the PLO in the second round was taking all the important seats instead of the local leaders that Israel should have cooperated with. After Israel opened universities in the occupied territories, and those became some kind of greenhouse for terror and so on. After doing all those mistakes, every mistake in the book, obviously that was then too late. So eventually we know that Israel left the Gaza Strip and now it's back in the Gaza Strip and so on and so forth. I'm not saying that the book is covering 60 years of occupation and dealing between Israelis and Palestinians. But what I am saying is that Tzvi's hypothesis is very interesting in the sense that we as a democratic people living in a democracy, Western people, we would like to think that every person will cherish democracy, will cherish this approach and so on and so forth. But what Tzvi is saying, and I want to emphasize that this is what Tzvi is saying, he's saying, this is not the Muslim culture. This is not the Muslim perception. As Napoleon has found out hundreds of years before, if you do not treat them in a way that they're dependent on you, they will eventually they will try to kill you. That's what we're seeing. You know, you can I've received a lot of criticism, and obviously this criticism is not targeted to me because I'm merely the editor, about the fact that how can you say such things about Muslims? How can you say such things about Arabs? This is racial, this is racist, this is that. I even had a Jewish literary agent from New York telling me that it's just like this orphan that goes into the court and says that he needs to get mercy because he killed his parents, he murdered his parents and now he's an orphan. So this literary Jewish agent said that this is the same argument that is being progressed in the book, which I find to be ridiculous. I mean, Tzvi had all the experience and the knowledge. He was speaking fluent Arabic. He was the first governor of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. He knew them by heart. And he's saying this is not their culture. He's talking about this Muslim belief that you it's allowed to hide your belief, your Muslim belief, if you're facing an occupier, if you're facing a foreigner. And that's exactly what they've done. There is this Muslim saying that the hand you wish to cripple, you kiss it and you pray it will be crippled. And that's basically what the Palestinians have been doing for decades in the occupied territories until it all bursted in the face of Israel. For me, whomever didn't listen in the past to Tzvi's approach, now I don't think you have any choice. I mean, it's in our face. It's just like it's so obvious that it was the wrong approach that was led by Moshe Dayan. And that is what the book is about. The book is talking from Tzvi's perspective on the first 10, 15 years after the 6 Days War, and how we, the Israelis, have treated everything wrongly.
It's interesting how the book, as you say, the time period that it covers, it stops kind of suddenly with the issues concerning the establishment of a university in the territories, the Beer Zayit University, which exists today. Do you have any idea why Tzvi kind of stopped there and didn't continue?
I think that there's a few reasons. One reason is that I think that he basically concluded his argument. He was talking about the first decade, more or less, after the Six-Day War. And my understanding from him, both from our conversation at the time and from the book, is that he believes that this first decade was the formative decade. That formed the relationship between the Israelis and the occupied Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. After that, it was a continuous process that started there. But my understanding from him was that this is what formed the discourse. This is what formed the relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That's one reason. I think the second reason is that that's the time when Tzvi was actually active in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. He later became the ambassador, the Israeli ambassador to Turkey. So even though he was involved and very much being a researcher of those issues, he personally was less involved. And it should be mentioned in this respect that he was a very acclaimed researcher of the Palestinian history. He wrote two books about the Great Mufti, the Grand Mufti, which was the first Palestinian leader in Jerusalem. Those are considered the standard around the Grand Mufti, which basically started this process of the Palestinian national recognition and so on.
Now, a central part of the book, at the very heart of the book, is Dayan's misunderstanding, arrogance, and ignorance, as you've already alluded to. So clearly, Tzvi Oppelig was in strong disagreement with Moshe Dayan's policies of appeasement with the Arab population in the occupied territories post-67. He must have been in dispute to some degree with Moshe Dayan. Was there any direct interaction between him and Dayan, as you're aware?
I'm not aware of, and I think there was a gap. So when Dayan, when in the 67, when the war started and ended, Tzvi was a colonel, and Dayan was much higher in the political ladder. So I think there was no direct discussion between the two. But I can tell you that I've had conversations with people that either have been part of the Dayan Center as researchers. One of them was the Israeli ambassador to the United States at one stage. So we're talking people that are very heavily connected to the Israeli politics and so on. And they were very dismissive of this approach as well. So they were saying, yes, the Americans pushed the Israelis to hold the elections and this and that. So what I felt was that they're dismissing this approach altogether, stating that the trying to bring democracy to the Palestinians was probably Israel's worst mistake since 67.
But when you say that Israel should have treated the Arab Palestinians in the territories in the same way as those in the triangle pre-67, you seem to be suggesting that Israel should have gone for not for a two-state solution, should have tried to bring all the Arab population together under Israeli control. Now, what would Tzvi have said about the demographic issues here, where we would have seen such a large Arab population existing within Israel?
So that's a good question. So Tzvi is not referring directly to this point. What he is saying is that when Israel started its kind of occupation of the Israeli Arabs in the Triangle and so on, there was no intention of making those people Israeli citizens. In fact, the government at the time was saying, let's control them, let's see how things unfold. But one of the things that Tzvi alludes to, and this actually is not part of the book because I felt it's a bit beyond the scope of the book, he talks a lot about those Arab Israelis. And in fact, he's saying that one of the things that incited those Arab Israelis against Israel is the Palestinians. So among the things that he's counting as negative in the way Israel dealt with the Palestinians in the occupied territories is the fact that terror then started to seep into the Israeli Arabs that before then were very loyal to the Israeli government. And in a way, that's also one of the ways that Tzvi is trying to illustrate his approach with respect to Muslims, where he talks about those Arab Israelis and how they adopted very quickly the Israeli culture and just wanted to become part of it. So they will never stop being Muslims. They will never stop being Arabs. But according to their culture, if they can be part of the occupier, if they can enjoy the budgets, if they can serve in the army, if, as we're seeing today, actually, maybe not with the Arab Israelis, but with the Bedouins and the Druze and so on, then they will do so. So Tzvi was basically saying, and a lot of those parts on the Arab Israelis have, did not make it into the book because I felt it will widen the scope too much. But he was basically saying Israel had its own experience with the Arab Israelis that was very successful. Why didn't we apply the same approach to the Palestinians? Why did Dayan decide to be so enlightened and democratic and so on, whereas we had our own experience? The Israeli had their own experience with the Arab Israelis that worked wonderful. They were dependent on us. They've done anything they can to identify with us. They were holding, so Tzvi's talking about ceremonies to the Israel Independent Day, where those Arab Israelis were wearing white and flagging, waving the flags of Israel and so on and so forth. And Tzvi is saying, why didn't we follow that? Why did we try this? Why did we do this experiment that eventually exploded in our face? We could have gotten the same results. And obviously the demographic aspect is relevant. That's one of the things he's talking about, the fact that when the borders were opened after 67, that's where the movement started. And the movement was mainly from the occupied territories into Israel rather than the other way around.
Now, I want to delve into one particular character that's in the book. I'm referring to Hamdi Kanaan, who was the mayor of Nablus. As we're talking, the book discusses the elections that Israel introduced thanks to Dayan's initiative, which brought about the serious situation where the PLO rose to prominence. Now, Hamdi Kanaan was the mayor of Nablus, but lost his position, but was seeking involvement or assistance from Israel to get back into the role that he had previously had. And although Israel had said that it wasn't wanting to particularly cooperate with anybody who was in the territories, they made an arrangement with Kanaan that seemed to go against what their policy was. So what happened here with Kanaan? He really didn't get much success, even though he was supported by Israel in his efforts to become the mayor again of Nablus.
I think if there's anything in the book that highlights in the best way the irony and the paradoxical aspect of this entire thing is the two rounds of elections. It's not by chance that the chapter name is forced elections. How can or forced democracy? How can you force elections? How can you force democracy? This is not democracy to begin with. And I think this shows the gap between, on one hand, Dayan's approach and his ignorance and arrogance, and at the same time, the reaction that came from the Palestinians. So Hamdi Kanaan is certainly a very good example to this approach, in the sense that Dayan's perspective was, if there are Arab leaders that are interested in collaborating with us, with the Israelis, then they're Quislings, meaning they're traitors, and we should not deal with them. And in fact, it should have been the other way around. So the first round of election was a big embarrassment, misunderstanding. Everyone was suspecting everyone. And then the second one, the PLO just realized that someone in the Israeli government is not really thinking through, and they just took most of the seats in the municipal government across the occupied territory. So in a way, if you will, Israel just handed over on a silver plate the control in the occupied territories to leaders that were either appointed by the PLO or were affiliated with the PLO. I'm not even getting into the story of those that have been assassinated by the PLO because they decided to run for the position, but they were not supported by the PLO, or they were interfering with people that were appointed by the PLO. The absurdity is that Israel is the one that actually created this situation. And then, as it states in the book, even the Americans, after the PLO leaders have been elected in a democratic election, then even the US is saying, why are you not willing to talk to them? They were actually elected. So, you know, it's like, go prove that you don't have a sister. If one stupid person throw a rock into a well, not even 10 wise people will take it out. And I think that's a very good illustration of the situation where Israel is now. I'm not saying it's the only mistake that Israel did during those 60, 70, almost 70 years, but it's certainly where it started. And I think that's one of the important part of, or the important aspects of this book, is that it shed lights on where it all started and why it started. And I think if you want to resolve something or you want to understand something, you need to start where, you need to look where it started and why it started and how did it start. And then you can maybe learn some lessons going forward.
You've been listening to an abbreviated version of an interview with Dr. Sean Goltz, who is a senior lecturer at the School of Business and Law, Edith Cowan University in Perth, West Australia. He has been instrumental in producing a book based on a manuscript that was left behind by Tzvi Elpeleg in 2015, who had a long career serving the Israeli government. I'll be making the full interview with Sean Goltz available as a separate podcast. May I add that I was only advised yesterday that the book that I have been discussing with Sean was available on Amazon, but Sean has just been approached by another publisher, so for the time being the book is unavailable, and I will let you know once it becomes available again for purchase. Please consider supporting what we are doing here at JAIR by becoming a member. Just go to the JAIR website to join. It only costs $54 per annum and will help us keep broadcasting for your benefit 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Let me conclude today's program, which is the 349th program that I have presented in almost 10 years of producing the Israel Connection on JAIR. Next week, indeed, marks a significant milestone for me with my 350th program, bringing up 10 years that the Israel Connection has been broadcast on JAIR. Tune in next week for a very special program. Ad Shavua Haba, Ani Agid Shalom Meha Israel Connection. Until next week, it's goodbye from the Israel Connection.